07-10-25 et al. Mr. David Robach et al.
May it please the court, I am Glenn Taubman for Sherry and David Perlot, and I've asked for 2 minutes for rebuttal. The first issue raised by the Perlots concerns the inadequacy of the union's financial disclosure. The board has now conceded that the Perlots' petition for review should be granted on that issue in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Hudson and this court's decision in Penrod. Therefore, I will move directly to the second issue in the case, which is, does Congress's authorization of union security clauses under Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act permit a union to force objecting non-members to pay for the costs of organizing and recruiting union members in other bargaining units? I submit the answer to this question is no. In Ellis versus Brack, the Supreme
Court. Why is that question even before?
Right before. Why do we have to decide that? Even if it's a viable issue, why would we venture there?
Because it's an open issue in light of the
board. There are lots of open issues in life.
It's an open issue in light of the board's remedy in this case, which ruled
it's
that.
It's not something we would have to decide in this context.
I don't understand.
You prevailed.
No, as I on that issue, as I pointed out in my brief, the board's remedy is that the money that was taken in the past has to be refunded, and then the cease and desist remedy, which has the prospective application, the cease and desist remedy is that the union can continue to collect for so-called chargeable organizing. That means after 18 years of litigation, my client, Mr. Perlot, who still works at this company, is going to have money taken out of his pay or be fired to fund continuing and future union organizing. That is the issue that we began with 18 years ago, asking the board and ultimately the courts to rule that 8A3 allows for no charging for organizing whatsoever. And the board's ruling says they can continue to charge for something called chargeable organizing. That is clear from their remedy. And the cease and desist order is inadequate to protect my client's rights. It violates their rights. And so it is very clear that if we walk out of this courtroom and that's the court's ruling, then my client will be paying for, quote, chargeable organizing. And you can see that as part of the board's remedy. I believe it's on page 304 of the appendix. Cease and desist from charging and collecting from objecting non-members in the bargaining unit dues and fees that are attributable to non-chargeable organizing expenditures. That means the union will continue on. They have said that, in their view,
all found they're all non-chargeable in this case.
As far as the past, but
you just read exactly what I thought. Cease and desist are non-chargeable, and that's the disposition of the case. These are non-chargeable. There isn't anything else that the union has claimed and met its burden on in this case.
But you're
suggesting that the union might in the future say, we can construct a different case. They've lost this case. They can't charge anything in this case. They've made their claim, and the public sector is out. They've made their claim on the private sector. They've lost it. They didn't meet their burden. And the board doesn't say anything to the contrary. They're out. Now, could the union in the future say, well, we're going to try it again? Yeah, and might you be back in court, maybe?
The union has said that they are going to try it again.
So and what? After eight. I mean, there's nothing for us to decide other than an advisory opinion here.
I don't believe it's an advisory opinion because after 18 years of litigation, the union has argued for various reasons that its due process was violated. And I would submit, Your Honors, that if any party has had due process violated in the last 18 years, it's my clients.
Let me go back, though. The argument was made that the complaint said the union can't charge for anything outside the bargaining unit. And a motion to dismiss was filed by the general counsel on the ground that that was clearly wrong under the board's precedent. The board denied that motion on the ground that, no, there was this lesser included theory.
Correct.
And you won on the lesser included theory.
I won in this case, but the remedy that the board ultimately gave is a remedy that consigns my client, who still works at this company, who still is subject to a Teamsters Union Security Clause, to continue to pay now and in the future.
That's not what you read.
Yeah.
It says what you read, unless I misheard you, and what I thought I remembered, was that they cannot charge your client for these non-chargeable expenses.
It doesn't say, Your Honor, it doesn't say cease and desist from collecting.
No. Don't tell me how you would prefer, in the best of all worlds, to have it written. What does it say?
It says cease and desist from charging and collecting from objecting non-members in the bargaining unit dues and fees that are attributable to non-chargeable organizing expenses.
Right.
The clear meaning of that is go right ahead and continue to charge for something called chargeable organizing expenses.
They haven't been able to make out a case here on chargeable expenses.
But
and so it's over. And that's what the board says. You cannot charge them for these non-chargeable expenses. You just can't do it.
The board's opinions, actually the majority, which is Chairman Batista and Member Liebman, says you can continue to charge for that we are not going to apply Ellis in all of its precepts and say that there is no charging for organizing. That's not.
Well, you're right. The board's current position, which you would like us to reach out to decide, is that in circumstances where the union can carry its burden of proof, they may be able to charge for some organizing expenses if they're germane to the union's responsibility as the collective bargaining agent. Yes, there's no question that's the board's current position. But I suspect there are a number of board current positions that you don't agree with. We can't reach all of them.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, though, the remedial order is, in fact, consigning my client to continue
to be charged
for that.
No, it really is not. I understand. It is not consigning your client to pay anything. You won the case.
Not on the remedy. This court has many opinions, which are cited in my briefs, that say that if you did not get the remedy that you are entitled to,
the remedy that sought was they cannot be charged for these organizing expenses, and the board agreed they cannot be charged for these organizing expenses.
The board agreed in this case the union failed to meet a burden of proof. So you win here, but going forward, you're going to be subject to this.
Yes, we're going around in circles. I hear you.
I would submit then on the merits, and I would hope that the court would reach the merits, that under Ellis.
Can I go back a little bit? The dissent was by Schauber, was it?
Schaumber.
Schaumber, right.
Yes.
And the majority was Batista and Liebman.
That is correct.
And there's a footnote in the opinion that says that although Chairman Batista has grave reservations about this Major case, whatever, Major, he finds it unnecessary to reach the issue in this case. So how can it possibly be that the issue is whether that is still good law, right? That's the issue he's talking about. How can it possibly be that they've decided that in the order as you interpret it?
Because the way I interpret this order, they're saying to the union, go forward, keep doing what you're doing, keep collecting.
Where does it say that? There's nothing that says that.
Well, that's
your interpretation.
That's the reality of what's going to happen.
But you're not answering Judge Randolph's question. One of the members of the board is saying, I'm not going to even reach it.
Well, by not reaching it, then you're allowing the behavior, which we contend is illegal, to continue. I mean, that's what this case has been about for 18 years, is my clients trying to stop the Teamsters Union from collecting money from them in violation.
We don't normally reach into a government agency and say, we're going to make, in the first instance, the statutory interpretations under the Chevron regime.
I don't.
And that's what you're asking us to do, and we're not going to do it. That's not what we do.
Well, Your Honor,
they've said you won this one, and one of the majority of the board is saying we're not reaching it. You know, we may relook at this again. Well, that's for them to relook at. And your client is not going to be required to pay anything under this judgment.
Well, my client will going forward. I can guarantee that, and that's why we're here.
Let me ask you, when you say you guarantee it, does that mean that you say Mr. Perlow, who is still employed, is that the amounts that were at issue in this case, I thought, were put in escrow, and the board ordered that now that money would be turned over to him. Are you representing to the court that in addition to the funds in escrow, there are charges that have been deducted from his pay?
What has happened in the ensuing years? Perhaps the union can answer that question. I don't know for a fact.
Well, he's your client.
If the union has put all of that money in escrow.
That was not my question.
Okay.
My question is, according to the record as I read it, this money is in escrow. All right? That was at issue in this case.
I don't know that for a fact, because the
union. That's what the board, I thought that was one of the board said.
I don't think that's really a fact. I think.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. Okay. All right, your client has a paycheck that's net pay $500 a week. The union has been taking out $50 all this time, and they've been putting it in escrow. Now, the board says all those $50 amounts your client is going to get back. Are you representing that in addition to the $50, so your client was only taking home $450, that another, say, $30 was being charged so that your client was only taking $420 home?
No, I'm not representing that at all.
So then you have won. All that money that was charged, your client is going to get back.
The retroactive money that was taken under the board's rule, my client will get back for the extent that it was charged for illegally for organizing. The going forward, the union has a current union security clause, and it will continue. I know I'm out of time, and I wanted to save time for rebuttal. Unless the court will grant me additional time, I will sit down.
We'll give you a few minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Fred Perillo. I represent Teamsters Local 75. I, too, would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Local 75 was denied due process of law in this case, not because the government put the burden of proof on my client and then refused to identify any specific non-chargeable expenses, but because my client was actively misled as to the nature and the scope of the issue on remand.
So this is a reference both to what the ALJ said on remand at the October hearing, namely that Meyer had decided the issue.
It was much stronger than that, Your Honor.
All right.
I apologize for interrupting.
Go
but
ahead.
Judge Biblowitz said, and I'll read directly, this is the same judge who had earlier sustained objection to my attempt to introduce evidence on the chargeability of organizing in the same competitive industry as Schreiber. And he said in the morning of the hearing, I'm talking about organization and representation where there are companies that are in the same business, same industries, competitive to Schreiber Foods.
This is JA 109, 110?
This is 110. And I think it's clear from my decision, and I still feel the same way. And the board and board subsequent decisions, that those expenses are clearly chargeable to the objectors. I don't think there's any question about that. He then went on to say what was involved, and he identified public sector organizing and organizing in industries other than Schreiber's industry. But that's not all. He then turned to the prosecuting attorney, Ms. Sizer, and asked her if she agreed, and she did. And she said, this is on the next page, I think that there's clearly, there's the two areas of organizing.
All right,
organizing,
so your point is not only did the judge define the issue, but the general counsel for the board agreed with the judge. Your, I don't know whether it was you personally, but your, the union attorney defined the issues the same. No one disagreed, and the hearing proceeded on that basis.
Well, and in fact, a few pages later, Mr. Taubman said, I basically agree with Ms. Sizer on what the
counsel,
scope of the remand is.
I'm just trying to collapse this and say, that's what you're relying on, isn't it? That the judge and all the parties thought that the Meyer issue was settled, and so there was no need to present evidence to support a claim of chargeability under Meyer.
It's stronger even than that, Your Honor, because I then moved to dismiss on that basis, and he denied that motion.
Okay.
And then he framed the issue in his decision on page 320 of the joint appendix as specifically being the issue not found in Meyer. 5 years later, the NLRB said that I had failed to meet my burden of proof on that issue, the one that the judge told me not to present evidence on. And I submit to Your Honors, the Administrative Procedures Act does not allow this. If you allow the government to put the burden of proof on the defendant, tell the defendant that the trial is about one thing, and then rule against him for failing to meet his burden of proof on an entirely different issue, why invite the defendant to the trial? We didn't get a fair trial on the issue.
Remind me, if you will, did the ALJ, and there's a difference between saying that the Meyer issue, that is, under Meyer, some organizing expenses are chargeable, and saying, which I can understand the ALJ might have said that's been resolved, and saying, you don't have to show anything here. In other words, merely because they are chargeable doesn't mean you've met your burden of proof. There could be a dispute over whether they're chargeable at all. Okay? That's one issue. That's just a legal question. Then there's a question as to whether or not you can show that these particular organizations expenses in your industry are attributable collective bargaining. Merely because some are doesn't mean that all are. And that's the way I'm reading the board's decision, is that some within the industry are, some are not. It's not a per se rule, and you've got to carry the burden in every instance to show it. Did the ALJ say, that's what I'm, and you're not really being clear on this, I have to go back and look at it. The ALJ say you can't put in anything to show that within the industry these charges were germane.
Well, he did say, I don't think that there's any question about that.
That you can charge some organizing expenses if you meet your burden of proof. Now, I'm not saying he said those words.
Well, but he said these words. Those expenses are clearly chargeable to the objectors.
Those that you want to charge, meaning as
expenses,
a per se rule?
Expenses which he defined as organization where there are companies that are in the same business, same industries, competitive to Schreiber Foods.
Was he saying that they are always, as a per se rule, they're always chargeable?
Merely
by identifying the industry?
In fact,
the board doesn't adopt that position.
If you read his decision on page 320 of the joint appendix, he actually does say that. He says that that was decided in Meyer and that he is now moving on to decide an issue not decided in Meyer.
Let me ask you, in his original decision, had he made that ruling? Because when you first started, you said, you know, the ALJ said, I originally ruled and I continue to think that these charges are chargeable.
He did, in fact, rule in his original decision back in 1992 that those expenses, organizing expenses, were chargeable, and he sustained Mr. Taubman's objection to my attempt to put evidence in on that point. And I think that's, he was referring to that when he said, I still feel the same way in the part of the decision I read.
In other words, is it the point that the ALJ was reading Meyer as establishing a rule, if I can put it that way?
I think he did.
In this sense, that when the board denied the general counsel's motion to dismiss, it also appeared to treat Meyer as a general rule.
And told the judge to consider Meyer.
Excuse me?
And told the judge to consider Meyer.
And what do you think the board meant by that? That's what Judge Edwards' questions are getting at.
The judge clearly...
Two distinct questions.
The judge...
Unless you think he was clearly saying it's a per se rule, they're two distinct questions. It's a legal question as to whether or not it's even possible to charge, this is what the intervener is objecting to, whether it's even possible to charge within the industry organizing expenses. And then the second question is, okay, assuming it's possible, you have the burden to show it, and you have to come forward.
He does say that specifically on page 320 of the joint appendix, but I want to go on to...
Does say what specifically?
He says that this, our case, the Pure Lot case, is the other case that the board was referring to, the one that it didn't decide. In the instant matter, the question is, can a union charge objectors for expenses incurred outside the industry?
No, I understand, and the board said that's not what they were talking about. That's still avoiding the question I'm asking, though.
If you read the preceding page, he says, in Meyer, the board found that at least with respect to organizing within the same competitive market as the bargaining unit employer, organizing expenses are chargeable to bargaining unit employees under California SAW. He was treating that as a closed question. I'm cutting into my rebuttal time.
He's not really answering it, and no one is joining it. He says that, but that doesn't answer the question as to what he understood about whether you now have to, they are chargeable, but only if you meet your burden of proof. He isn't
but
saying.
But what I'm trying to just be clear about, the ALJ at the first hearing sustained the petitioner's objection to the union's offer to put proof on as to chargeability of the within industry expenses.
Right.
That's correct.
Then on the second remand, the ALJ says, I continue to think I was correct about that.
He said, I still feel the same way.
And all the parties said, essentially, therefore, the only issues that are to be litigated at this October remand hearing are, and they list other things, but they do not list within bargaining industry charges.
That's correct.
And that is your argument, at least as to the argument that while, as Judge Edwards points out, there are two questions, when you look at what the ALJ said at the second hearing, in light of what he said in the first, everyone assumed that there was no question that the ALJ was reading Meyer as a rule.
No one disagreed with him. Judge Edwards, I want to turn to that issue of proof, because in Meyer, the local union in Newport, Michigan, a small town in Michigan, presented evidence that related to the 73 largest cities in the United States. That's right in the Meyer decision. We presented that same evidence, and I think you all know that New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and Miami and San Diego are not in proximity to Newport, Michigan. The board accepted that evidence in the case of the Michigan local. They rejected the same evidence with respect to the Green Bay local. That is an unreasoned departure from the board's precedent. The board mocks me for saying that I have my own interpretation of Meyer that's better than the board's. That's not my complaint. My complaint is that the board is not entitled to two inconsistent views of Meyer. I've cut into my time for rebuttal. I've used it all. In fact, I thank you. I thank the court for listening to the concerns of Local 75.
Good morning. May it please the court, Amy Ginn for the National Labor Relations Board. I will pick up where we just left off with the union's, argument about the judge's interpretation of Meyer. Of course, the judge's interpretation of Meyer is not what carries the day here, but the board's interpretation.
No question
That's
about
no
that.
Answer.
The only issue is whether or not, given the board's interpretation, that it made very clear in its supplemental decision whether or not the parties at the October hearing proceeded on that same basis, so that, as Judge Edwards had said, that there were two separate questions.
Correct. There are two separate questions here. And even if the judge at the second remand said I mean, the judge did make statements about Meyer, and his opinion of Meyer was that the board has now decided that organizing expenses within competitive industries can be chargeable.
And he did not allow any further testimony on that.
That's actually not a correct statement.
At the original hearing.
At the original hearing.
And he said, my view has not changed.
At the original hearing, the judge did not allow the testimony, which is, in large measure, when you read the board's remand order, why they remanded, because they wanted that information. They wanted those questions answered.
Where does the board say that in the remand order?
In the board's decision in order from 1999.
Page 279.
Thank you, Your Honor. The board lists specific questions. They cite to the Connecticut limousine decision. And they list specific questions that they want answered on remand. They say the judge shall consider these relevant questions, including whether organizing expenses are necessary to preserve uniformity of labor standards, and what kinds of employers in the company's specific industry the union might attempt to organize to preserve those standards.
Now, it is your argument that, given what the ALJ said on the remand, that is, it's kind of loose, it isn't entirely clear to me what the ALJ meant to say, and without reference to what the ALJ's view was the first time around, the union never said, look, we want to introduce this evidence. Is that essentially what you're saying?
That's correct. The union did not attempt to put in evidence at the second hearing that the judge refused to accept.
The board could not have been clearer. It says the judge shall consider the questions that you just on remand, the judge shall, in considering the chargeability of these expenses, shall consider the questions deemed relevant by the board in the case they didn't decide because it got settled. Right?
I mean, the problem here is that we've had cases where this court has remanded and instructed the district court to address certain issues. And the district court on remand has decided it wishes to proceed another way. And the question I had in my mind here is the board was clear. But did the ALJ, as it were, go off on a frolic of his own, just saying, look, I've decided this question, and we're proceeding. And then the general counsel for the board doesn't disabuse the ALJ as to what the issues are on remand. And the Perlow's attorney doesn't say, no, what's on remand is broader. And so the hearing proceeds along the lines that the ALJ defines. That's all I'm getting at.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think that, you know, the board's response to this in its 2007 decision is to say nothing in the remand order or in its later February 2001 order supports this view that the ALJ apparently took of the remand or that the parties apparently took of the remand. And
well, you see, it's not enough to say that's not fair if that the first part of what you said, if the ALJ really took the view and enforced the view that you cannot put in, you cannot address the second question, not the Meyer general legal question, but that you can't put in the evidence, the board should opinion should be struck down because they can't say, well, even though this is our trier of the fact, too bad, life's sad, and we're going to ignore it. That would be totally unfair.
The judge did not.
The question is whether or not the judge in fact precluded the union from doing what the remand order said it was supposed to do.
The judge did not exclude any evidence or refuse to accept any evidence that the union offered at the second remand hearing.
The order of February 5th, 2001,
yes.
Is that in the joint appendix?
Yes, it is actually in the joint appendix. However, it was not in the table of contents, so I missed it on first view.
It's JA244. Now, I was just going to get to that, because in that order,
yes,
at JA246, the board states in denying the general counsel's motion to dismiss this proceeding based on the original allegations of the petition, says the non-unit expenses involved here involve organizational expenses and other expenses. In regard to the former, the judge should consider the board's decision in Mayer, which issued after the remand order. In Mayer, the board held, quote, that at least with respect to organizing within the same competitive market as the bargaining unit employer, comma, organizing expenses are chargeable under California law. So there, I mean, it appears that the board is reading mayor as establishing a general rule. So what's to prove?
Your Honor, even if, and I mean, the board has made clear in its decision now that Meyer was not intended as a per se rule of chargeability for within competitive industry. But even in the event that that were the interpretation of Meyer that the judge and the parties took up at the remand hearing, still the union would have to put on some type of evidence about what Schreiber's competitive industry was. And there's no evidence of that put on at the remand.
No, but the petition is based on, look, I make $500 net pay. The union is holding back $50. And the union is holding that back as associated with organizing expenses as to employers, to employees of employers within the competitive market as Mr. Perlow's employer. That's the issue in the case. So, I mean, there isn't any issue about this $50. That's why the union is withholding it. They say they can organize employees within the competitive market of the bargaining unit. That's the $50.
The amount of money that has been withheld from the Perlots' pay, of course, is for all these different union expenditures, many that are not at issue in this case. And the organizing expenses issue was delineated in two different ways, right? One way with the competitive industry, one way outside the competitive industry. Of course, what was at issue here and what the only evidence in the record indicates that the union was attempting to do some organizing within cheese and food processing industry. So we don't know what other types of organizing the union may or may not have been doing.
But this case is about the $50.
Okay.
For charging for organizing efforts within the competitive industry. In other words, what I'm trying to say, if the board denies the general counsel's motion to dismiss on the grounds that this $50 is chargeable expenses, then what does the board mean that it wants the ALJ to consider what is the ALJ supposed to consider on remand?
Well, Your Honor, if in fact the board had decided in Meyer that there was a per se rule that within industry organizing expenses were per se chargeable.
No, Edwards' hypothetical.
Okay,
not
I'm
hypothetical,
sorry.
But his question, where he says, first is a question, could you ever charge for
yes.
these expenses? And then the second question is, are the particular deductions being made properly characterized as falling within the Meyer rule?
And that is the question on remand.
Okay.
They didn't put any evidence.
But what I'm trying to understand is the way this case came forward. As I understood it, Mr. Perlow says, I want my $50 back. And the union says, no, under Meyer, we can do that because those were charges in the competitive industry. And Mr. Perlow says, but you can't make any deductions outside the bargaining unit. In other words, I'm just trying to understand what's the dispute here. If it's just the $50 and they're only charged as regards the competitive industry and the board says, well, those are chargeable, What evidence do you put on? Mr. Perlow isn't saying that this isn't within the competitive industry. The general counsel doesn't say it's within the contesting that this charge is for within the competitive industry.
Well, you're saying the board says even within the competitive industry, you've got to show not all of those charges are going to be allowed.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. The union still has a burden of proof to show under
right.
California SAW.
I mean, it's soft. I mean, the problem is the board, first of all, they're obviously uncomfortable. They don't know what they want to do here. That's one of the problems. They're all over the place. And it doesn't make it easy for us because we're supposed to defer, and deferring to mush is difficult. But I think the best evidence or the best shot you have is to say, even though they said, you know, look at Meyer, if you look at Meyer, as the board now says after the fact, Meyer has a lot of evidence about both an expert and whose testimony, no, Ellis had the expert. Ellis didn't. Meyer had the expert
Correct.
Who was tight, and then the board agent who tied it up with anecdotal evidence that made the expert's testimony have meaning. And so if you had read Meyer carefully on remand, you would have understood That's what we mean when we say apply Meyer. You've got to put in that kind of evidence. That's your argument, as I understand it.
That's correct, Your Honor. The type of evidence that was put on here, of course, was nothing like the there were some similarities to the evidence in Meyer, but it didn't go nearly that far, not only with respect to the anecdotal type of evidence from actual union representatives.
Well, the board didn't like the expert's testimony. It was just too general, as I remember.
The expert testimony in this case was more general than the expert testimony in Meyer, which was focused there on the retail grocery industry.
What's the California SAW standard?
The California SAW standard, Your Honor, is that a union may charge objectors for expenses outside the bargaining unit if they are germane to the union's role in collective bargaining. If they are germane to the union's role in collective bargaining and are incurred for services that may ultimately inure to the benefit of unit members.
So there at least is some ambiguity in the October, the February order. It says that you can charge organizing expenses in the competitive market under the California SAW standard. Now, the California SAW standard requires proof in each instance of germane and benefit, then there's no ambiguity here, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Your point is that even if it doesn't, I mean, even if you construe this as a per se rule, what we have, I just want to understand this because I'm a little confused now. I thought I understood this case, but now I'm not sure. You have a whole bunch of expenses. Some of them are organizing expenses. The case gets remanded on the organizing expenses, and the union doesn't put any evidence in to show which are outside the competitive market or which are inside the competitive market.
That's correct. There was no discussion as to which.
That's not correct. Yeah. That is absolutely not correct. The union had split that up.
Right.
That was not the fight. The fight, as I understand it, is forget the outside.
Right.
And forget the public sector. Though within, there was no proof on germane. That's what the board is saying.
That's the board's decision here, yes,
right.
That there was no proof on the California SAW.
There wasn't any doubt about the $50 that Judge Rogers has been talking about hypothetically. That was within the industry. The union had shown that. That wasn't an issue. No one disputed that. The interveners say, we don't care, within, without, you can't charge any of it. And so the only fight now was whether it's a per se rule, we win because it's within. That's all we have to show is it's within, and we've shown that. Or we have to now show it's within and then show it's germane. That's the issue. There's no question that's what the board's saying. And I thought that's what you were agreeing initially.
What the board has said here is that for the within industry organizing expenses, the union did not meet its burden of showing germaneness under California SAW.
Didn't meet their burden. Judge Randolph asked, did they fail to show that it was within industry? No, they showed it was within industry. They didn't show that it was germane.
I thought I heard you say they put no evidence on of what the competitive market was.
The only evidence of what the competitive market was here was in the first hearing, they discussed that Schreiber Foods was in cheese and food processing.
That's it, period. So we don't, how could they show what was organizing within the competitive market and what was organizing without the competitive, outside? If they've never put in any evidence, it's like an antitrust case, which you fail to discuss, to put on evidence of what the market is. They didn't put on any evidence of what the market is. So I don't understand how they, even if it's a per se rule. All
right. You want to cede your time and go home, huh?
Not yet, Your Honor, not yet. I would like to just address briefly with respect to the charging party's argument here with respect to being aggrieved. Any reading of the board's order here, the cease and desist provision of the order, shows that the union cannot charge for any of its organizing expenses because the union failed to prove that any were germane, as we've just been discussing. And there's nothing in the board's order that indicates that going forward the union would be able to charge for those expenses.
Well, let me ask you just one other thing about the record that you haven't mentioned. Along the lines of what Judge Edwards was just saying, if you read the remand proceeding, the union did offer some evidence.
Are you referring to at the remand hearing?
Yeah.
At the remand hearing, the union put on evidence in the form
of Professor Berman.
Bellman, correct, the labor economist Bellman.
Right.
Who testified with respect to economic studies showing that in certain...
No, but my point is, if the union thought the issue was not before the ALJ, why would it have offered any testimony by Professor Bellman?
Well, Your Honor, the union obviously could answer that question better with respect to...
No, 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 but isn't that to support your position?
Support your position.
That the issue was a live question before the ALJ at the October hearing, and the fact that the union put on some evidence indicates it understood that it had a burden, an evidentiary burden. That's all. I'm not asking you to look in the union's mind, but just why doesn't that part of the record support your interpretation?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that it's clear, the board is clear, and all parties are clear that the union was addressing organizing expenses at the remand hearing. As to what aspect of organizing expenses they were addressing, that would be the dispute. If there are no further questions, with the exception of a limited remand regarding insufficiency of the union's initial financial disclosure statement, the board asks this court to enforce its orders in full.
Thank you. I don't think either the individuals or the union has any time, but I'll give both of you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would like to address the points that have just occupied the court's time. At the remand hearing, the ALJ never said that the union was precluded from putting on any evidence of any kind, whether it was in industry, out of industry, never said anything like that. Number two, neither the general counsel nor I objected to a single proffer of Teamsters' evidence at the remand hearing. And the reason for that is we assumed, as what the board's 1999 remand order was, that this was an open question. In fact, if you look at my statement, which is on appendix page 113 and 114, I said, I don't think that Leonard or California saw foreclosed this sort of analysis. I think what they actually said was the burden of proof was on the union to show that its expenditures in the extra unit area inured to the benefit of the already represented non-member. So I don't think it's correct to say that any of this is foreclosed. Third, the union chose not to recall its president, whose name is Jagar, G-E-G-A-R-E, whose testimony was cut off in the first hearing by my objection. I have to say, I'm not about to tell the union how to litigate its cases, but I was rather shocked that they did not recall him and put on any additional evidence of the kind that was cut off at the first hearing. And
say the ALJ said I was right at the first hearing. And I continue to think I'm right.
Well, it's in the...
I understand your point, though.
Right, but there was never an effort to cut off anything that the union was going to put on.
Did the union put on any evidence about what the competitive market was as opposed to the outside of the competitive market?
No, the evidence in this case that the union put on was incredibly sparse. There is nothing to really show what the competitive market is. There is nothing to show what any of their particular organizing campaigns were. There's nothing to show how any of them actually benefited my clients, a single worker at the Schreiber Foods Union. None at all. Thank you, Your Honors.
That evidence is found on pages 71 and 72 of the joint appendix. It's pages 177 and 178 of the original trial transcript. It defines the relevant market, and in fact, the identical anecdotal evidence relied upon in Meyer for Local 951, namely that
how
the organizing
was spent on the organizing within the competitive market. Where's the evidence of that?
The quantity of dollars was not submitted into evidence. It was the testimony.
None of it was spent within the competitive market. On this record, we can't assume any otherwise, right?
We know that some was because six specific organizing campaigns were identified in the testimony, and they couldn't have cost $0.
But after the ALJ at the October hearing denied your motion to dismiss on the grounds that the general counsel had not established a prima facie case, then why wouldn't you have had to offer evidence along the lines that Judge Randolph was questioning you about?
We already had in the record the testimony about germaneness that was identical to the testimony presented in Meyer, namely that the organized employer had complained about non-union competition and had urged the union to go out and organize competitors.
Well, if you think you already had the evidence in, then that's just that there's no due process question. You just disagree with the board's review of the evidence, that's all.
No, Your Honor, that's not the reason.
The board closed you from putting the germane evidence in. And your answer to Judge Rogers is we already had it in. That's why we weren't putting more in. Well, you weren't foreclosed from doing anything.
My argument, Your Honor, is if we presented the identical evidence that was presented in Meyer.
That's an argument about the board's review of the evidence. We understand that. You disagree.
And that there's an unreasoned departure from Meyer.
Yeah, we understand that argument, but that's different from your claim that you were foreclosed from putting in the evidence.
And that argument relates, Your Honor, to the board's contention now that Meyer actually had a much higher bar. And in that case, the judge led us to believe that that issue wasn't on the table. He told us that there were two different issues he wanted us to present evidence on, and we did.
Using a harmless error analysis, it wouldn't have mattered because you claim that even if there was a higher bar, we put in whatever Meyer required, because you're saying it's the same.
We attempted to do what the board said.
It's a due process argument.
I believe, Your Honor.
You say whatever it is, they switched on us, but whatever it is that they think Meyer requires, we have it in here. So now it's a question as to whether the board read the evidence correctly.
It's a question of fairness, Your Honor. The board is claiming that I shot at the wrong target, and I shot at the target the judge told me to try to hit. Thank you, Your Honor.